In 2005, Franklin Leonard was a development executive at Leonardo DiCaprio's production company Appian Way, and he was worried he was bad at his job. That job was mostly finding new scripts that would make good movies, so like all people who are worried they're bad at their job, Leonard decided to crowdsource some ideas. He cracked open his contact list and emailed 75 people who also worked in development, asking them to name the 10 best unproduced scripts they'd read that year. Leonard then tallied the votes into a list of the best liked scripts in town and sent it back to everyone who'd voted, so they could all cheat at their jobs. Leonard called it the Blacklist, in reference to the McCarthy-era blacklisting of communist screenwriters, but also as a conscious subversion of the idea that black is a negative word. There were 286 scripts on that first blacklist, and 120 of them have since been turned into films. In the decades since, the Blacklist has become a Hollywood institution, an annual celebration of scripts that might not make good business sense, but still fascinate their readers. There is a common misconception that the Blacklist is a list of spec scripts, or speculative scripts, which are uncommissioned scripts written essentially for free by the writer on the hope that they'll later be able to sell the project to a studio or production company. But while there are a lot of spec scripts on the Blacklist, it's not a requirement. A script only needs to be unproduced to make the list. Plenty of scripts on the Blacklist are about to go into production and already have a director and cast attached, and they can be major studio projects. One of the 2010 Blacklist scripts was The Hunger Games. It's also worth mentioning that while the Blacklist is a list of well-liked scripts, that doesn't always translate into a list of great movies. Sometimes the thing that makes a script compelling to a reader just doesn't translate on screen, or the zeitgeist is gone, or the director decides to cast Mel Gibson. For every Imitation Game, Zodiac, Whiplash, and Juno, there's a Dracula Untold, 47 Ronin, Gangster Squad, and The Beaver. The 2019 Blacklist is a really great example of this, because one of my favourite films of the past few years, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, was tied for fourth place. And above it, in third, was the Van Dyke Brothers spec script, Don't Worry, Darling. This is Going Rogue, and this is the Don't Worry Darling story that didn't get much attention. The story of the film itself. The quote-unquote drama of Don't Worry Darling has been raked over in fine detail by far more online people than me, but in all of that, relatively little has been said about the actual film, which, I'm gonna spoil this for you now, is not a good film. It's a nice-looking but bland, unfocused Stepford Wives riff with real pacing issues and a confused message. But walking out of the cinema, I was really struck by how many missed opportunities the film had. Wasted character moments, missing bits of foreshadowing, but also setups that never paid off, and it just felt like there was a much stronger film sitting just beneath the surface. And it turned out, there was. There was a script for Don't Worry Darling that solved most of the film's problems. But it wasn't the script on the 2019 Blacklist. So this episode of Going Rogue is all about scripts and rewriting and how a director's decisions can undermine the meaning of a film. I'm your host, Tansy Gardam, and here's your spoiler warning. We are going to discuss every twist and turn of Don't Worry Darling in detail this episode, but we are not going to cover any of the press tour or personal drama around this film beyond a couple of specific instances which relate directly to the film and its execution. Also, I want to give full warning, this film is all about misogyny, and every draft involves some form of sexual assault, sexual violence, and suicide. So if those are things that you don't want to engage with, I'd advise skipping this episode. Carrie and Shane Van Dyke had been working together as a screenwriting duo for about a decade when Don't Worry Darling landed on the Blacklist. Most of their previous work had been very different. Mockbusters and schlockbusters like Titanic 2. And if you're wondering, yes, they are related to Dick Van Dyke. He's their grandfather. The film's title, Don't Worry Darling, came from a 1952 Schlitz beer advertisement, which you've probably seen. It shows a man consoling a sobbing woman in front of a burning stove with the words, "Don't worry, darling, you didn't burn the beer." This was an American ad. I just can't do an American accent. And the Van Dyke Brothers script opened with an unseen man assembling a collage of these sexist old ads like the Schlitz beer one before cutting to a 1950s suburban neighbourhood and the home of married couple Evelyn and Clifford Peterson. Cracks immediately start showing in Evelyn's perfect housewife facade. She's secretly using birth control and she's plagued by dreams of being a surgeon. But the first act mostly plays out like a period piece domestic drama. We see Evelyn's underwhelming, repressed life, and when Clifford discovers she's using birth control, he becomes physically violent before acting like nothing has happened the next day. But things really take a turn when Evelyn is out grocery shopping and sees Clifford disappearing into a motel. A man in black tries to stop Evelyn from following her husband, but she brushes him off, opens the motel room door to a flash of blinding light, and wakes up in a basement, in some kind of machine with a head full of electrodes and a feeding tube plugged into her arm. Evelyn unhooks herself from the machine, but before she can leave the basement, Clifford appears and grabs her, sedates her, and starts to plug her back in, muttering that she must have found his exit portal and he'll have to program a new one. He tells her that this is all a bad dream, and that, quote, "Don't worry, darling, I'll see you real soon." Evelyn then wakes up, back in the 1950s. I want to flag that this happens on page 21 of 95, or roughly 20 minutes into the film. The position of this reveal in the story changes wildly between drafts, but in the initial Van Dyke Brothers spec script, the fact that Evelyn was in a 1950s simulation was revealed at the end of the first act. Also, that's the big twist, if you didn't know. She's in the Tradwife Matrix. And once this is revealed, Evelyn is on edge for the rest of the film. When she wakes up back in the 50s, she immediately books it to the motel, but when she opens the room, it's just a motel room. Clifford takes her to see Dr. Anderson, who diagnoses her with Women Be Crazy disease and prescribes some tranquilizers. And Evelyn tries to return to her housewife duties, but she keeps having these strange, upsetting visions. She sees neighborhood kids doing the exact same thing over and over, sees her neighbor Betsy with an open skull and exposed brain. And she finally asks Clifford what an exit portal is, but he acts like he's never heard of one before. She starts following him, sees him disappear into an empty house which is being sold by a company called Alt Life Realty, but before Evelyn can follow him, a nosy dog walker stops her. She starts driving around town looking for proof or a way out, and realizes Clifford's briefcase is still in the car. And when she opens it, it's full of the 1950s ad collages from the beginning of the film, although they've also been covered in hand-drawn phallic graffiti, which, according to the script, is what confirms to Evelyn that her husband is a fucking monster. I don't want to be too much of a feminist killjoy, but the whole physical violence and gaslighting thing is much more of a red flag to me than drawing dicks on some old ads. After finding all the old ads, Evelyn drives back to that empty house that Clifford went into and climbs in a window and wakes up in the machine in the basement. She manages to unhook herself and there's no sign of Clifford, but her muscles are wasted and weak and can't support her weight, so she has to commando crawl up the stairs and into a house full of holographic computer screens. She drags herself to the window to see a futuristic New York City skyline, and when she starts sorting through the mess of the house, she finds a newspaper from 2050 announcing another 4-year term for America's black female president. Then she finds her and Clifford's divorce papers. Then, on one of the computers, she finds a bunch of files labeled Alt Life, and recognizing the name from the for sale sign at the empty house, she opens them to discover a video of Dr. Anderson welcoming Clifford to Alt Life, a society of men, by men, and for men. A digital world designed to resemble 1950s America, where you plug in your chosen woman after kidnapping her and faking her death, so that, quote, "in no time she'll be back in the kitchen where she belongs." I was not kidding about the American accent. This is all happening around page 50. It's the midpoint of the film, which is usually a significant shift in the goal or motivation of your lead character. Evelyn keeps looking around the future house and finds news articles about her celebrated career as a neurosurgeon and the death that Clifford faked for her. And then she hears Clifford returning, and knowing that she's too weak to fully escape yet, she races back to the basement to plug herself back into Alt Life before he can know that she knows it's a simulation. She just makes it, and back inside, She's now playing nice and playing along, trying to find a way out without making Clifford suspicious. She cooks him dinner, spiking it with the tranquilizers that Dr. Anderson gave her, but Clifford refuses to eat and slowly reveals that he's seen through the ruse. So Evelyn claws his face with her manicured nails and makes a run for the empty house, only to discover that once again, the exit portal is gone. Clifford arrives with the police and Dr. Anderson, and Evelyn is dragged away to an asylum and given electroshock therapy. She returns home as a blank slate, perfect wife, cooking and cleaning and sucking and fucking. But while she's doing the laundry, she finds a motel room key, and it all comes flooding back. She borrows some gardening tools from her neighbour Betsy and makes Clifford dinner again, and there's another long dinner table conversation where Clifford suggests that they should have a baby, and Evelyn stabs him through the hand with a garden trowel. Clifford passes out and wakes up gagged and tied to the bed. Evelyn then repeats a lot of the things that he's said to her every time she's woken up back in alt life after almost escaping, and then proceeds to graphically torture him to find a way out. Skip ahead 30 seconds if you don't want details, but this scene's really nasty to read, and it culminates in Evelyn threatening to shove a broom handle up Clifford's ass in a way that is explicitly framed as a retributive rape, as her doing to him what he's done to her. And after Clifford caves to this threat and tells Evelyn exactly where the portal is, she does it anyway. Like I said, it's nasty, and it's made worse by the fact that it's framed as both a girl power moment and as a comedy beat. Evelyn then uses the final exit portal to return to 2050 and starts dragging herself up the stairs on wasted limbs as, in alt life, Clifford begins to break through his restraints. In the real world, Evelyn gets out of the basement and is about to open the front door of the house when Clifford grabs her and throws her through a glass coffee table, then drags her back to the kitchen, planning to lobotomize her with a screwdriver, keeping her body alive but her brain dead. Clifford gloats that a successful marriage starts in the kitchen, but Evelyn tells him he forgot one thing. The kitchen's where the knives are. That's the line in the script. It's written as a big mic drop moment, but it's such a baffling line that I had to include it. Anyway, Evelyn stabs Clifford with both the knife and the screwdriver over and over until they're both bleeding out on the kitchen floor. But as Evelyn stares up at the ceiling, we cut back to the 50s, to the same scene with a blood-curdling scream as Betsy discovers them and calls an ambulance. Evelyn is taken to hospital while Clifford is taken to the morgue. Dr. Anderson diagnoses Evelyn with a severe case of women be crazy disease, telling her she made up the whole simulation as a metaphor for feeling trapped as a housewife, and Evelyn tries to argue, but it only makes her seem crazier. So Dr. Anderson offers her a choice. Admit she made everything up, or be lobotomized. She refuses to lie, biting off a piece of Dr. Anderson's cheek before they can tranquilize her, and we cut to a sedated Evelyn being visited by Betsy in the asylum. Evelyn is non-responsive as Betsy leans in and whispers that she was right and that there's an exit portal in the door behind her. She still doesn't even respond as Betsy leaves. But once she's gone, Evelyn stands, walks towards the door, opens it to a flash of blinding light, and cut to black. There are a lot of reasons why this script would appeal to film producers. When it eventually went to market, Mike Fleming Jr. wrote in Deadline that, quote, "Like elevated genre fare that includes Get Out, Don't Worry Darling is a smart concept that is timely in the Time's Up era and can be executed as a reasonable budget. There is a strong male lead role as well," end quote. But in spite of these strengths, or maybe because of them, the Van Dyke Brothers script for Don't Worry Darling really feels like an episode of Black Mirror. Not just in its content with the simulation and the 2050 reveal, but also in its construction. There's a fairly limited cast, a few key locations that are mostly interiors, a lot of dialogue scenes, and one big showpiece fight at the end. It's the sort of thing you'd write if you were limited by the budget and scope of television. Also, this is my opinion, but the Van Dyke script has big written by men energy. And this isn't just a flippant dismissal of the script. I'm not saying men can't write women and women can't write men, but I will say that women are more adept at writing men because we're socialized at a young age to identify with male characters as the default. So women just have more casual experience living inside male perspectives. And if you want to argue this point, just compare the number of women you know who've read Harry Potter with the number of men who've read Twilight. But the male perspective in this first version of Don't Worry Darling goes much deeper than just an outsider's view on life as a woman. It's written with external goals. To explain this, I want to take a look at a quote from Ron Bass, the co-writer of Rain Man, The Joy Luck Club, and the terrible 2022 Fleabag rip-off version of Persuasion. He once talked about what he thought of as the difference between writing male and female characters, and also, in his opinion, the difference between male and female writers, saying, quote, "In my experience, there is a big gender difference. Men are results-oriented. Fuck the girl, win the prize, beat up the guy, get the money, close the deal, win the game. And they do not want to know. They do not want an inner life. Women are process-oriented. They have to have an inner life." I don't 100% agree with this take, and I think Bass is kind of telling on himself, especially since he goes on to say that he prefers writing women, and he wrote the Tom Cruise character in Rain Man as a man becoming more like a woman. But it is a really interesting lens to look at Don't Worry Darling, because in the Van Dyke Brothers script, Evelyn is results-oriented. She needs to get out. She has to do X, Y, and Z to do it, and in the end, she does get out. She wins the film. It's an external journey of discovery where Evelyn very quickly learns that something is wrong, and while people gaslight her and try to tell her she's crazy, she never truly doubts herself. Even in the first scenes of this script, she's rebelling against her social programming by using birth control. She is immediately marked as different to the society she lives in. But if you've seen the film, you'll know that in the hands of female creatives, Don't Worry Darling became as much about internal emancipation as external social pressures. Because when you've been under those social pressures your whole life, the first person to call you crazy is usually yourself. Don't Worry Darling was written as a spec script, but by the time it was on the 2019 blacklist, it had already found a director, a studio, and its next writer. In May 2019, Olivia Wilde's first film, Booksmart, was released to rave reviews and solid box office, earning around $25 million on a $6 million budget. The script for Booksmart had also been on the blacklist way back in 2009, but it went through quite a lot of rewrites by the time it was actually made, the last of which was done by Katie Silberman. Silberman had read the original draft of Booksmart back in 2009 and she liked it, but she was also keenly aware of how much the world had changed for young women between 2009 and 2017. So when she was updating the script, she based it on her own high school and college experience. Here's Silberman speaking at UC Santa Barbara in 2022.
I felt like high school movies are similar to high school and that it feels really easy to diagnose every kind of person in the movie immediately based on knowing one or two things about them. And I wanted to tell a story that reflected more of my high school experience, which was that I considered myself really smart and that was my thing and I didn't do fun stuff because that was for later. And then when I got to college, all the smartest people I knew were really fun. And I realized that if I had known them in high school, I would have assumed they were cool kids. And then they showed up and were way smarter than me. So I was like, I kind of did that wrong. And I was excited for the opportunity to show, to make a movie where the whole point was to establish a high school the way we think we've seen them in movies. And then over the course of the story, pull back to reveal that everybody is so much more than what Molly and we, the audience, first thought when we saw them.
Katie Silberman was also a producer on Booksmart, so she was constantly tightening the script to suit the actors' voices, and she worked really closely with director Olivia Wilde. So when Wilde and Silberman started pitching new projects, Booksmart was their calling card. And it was a card you called back. They quickly sold a holiday comedy pitch to Universal, but Olivia Wilde didn't want to get pigeonholed into just making comedies. For her, the Don't Worry Darling journey really started with three things: a genre, a script, and a conversation. Here's Wilde talking about why she wanted to make this film on the Director's Cut podcast.
I think it was a combination of really wanting to make a psychological thriller because I love them. And like comedies, you know, it's a process of misdirecting the audience. It's pulling the tension and release, like everything is, but taking them by surprise in much the same way as crafting a comedy. But I also was really taken by the concept. We found this story by the Van Dyke brothers that had the very, very kind of the germ of this idea. And we turned it into this film because I was really kind of trying to explore this notion I had of who is willing to actually disrupt the system that serves them. And it came from this conversation I randomly had with Gloria Steinem. And at this moment, like, changed my life and is the reason for this film. It was right after Trump was elected, and I happened to be at this event, and I went up to her and bothered her, and I really sort of fell at her feet, and I was like, Gloria, what are we going to do? Like, just devastated, like so many of us were, really, really depressed. And she looked at me and she said, stop paying taxes. And I was like, I don't know. Can I do that? Is that allowed? I don't know. That seems extreme. I can't stop. I can't. I'm like a mom. I can't. What? Really? And she was like, that's the reason nothing will change. Because until you're willing to really stop participating in the system continues. And I thought about that so much. And I was like, I want to tell a story about that. That's what I want to talk about. Who's the kind of superhero or superheroine who is really willing to disrupt a system that is designed for them?
So in July 2019, Olivia Wilde and Katie Silverman started pitching Don't Worry Darling to major studios, with Wilde attached to direct and Silverman already on board to rewrite the Van Dyke Brothers script. 18 separate companies tried to buy the project, including Netflix, Legendary, Film Nation, and Blumhouse, which is a pretty wild mix of companies to all be bidding on the same project. Don't Worry Darling came with a $20 million budget, so these studios were competing for the right to pay that budget and secure Wilde and Silverman on the assumption that the final project would more than make that money back. The film ended up going to New Line Cinema, which is a subsidiary of Warner Brothers. They were once an independent company, and then they were bought by Warner's, and they initially operated as a separate studio with Warner backing, kind of like how Marvel and Lucasfilm operate under Disney's ownership, but these days they're completely absorbed into Warner Brothers. So while New Line made Don't Worry Darling, it was also technically really a Warner Brothers film. Katie Silverman hadn't done her rewrite when all these companies were bidding on Don't Worry Darling, but her vision was presented alongside the film's pitch documents, so potential studios knew how she was planning to update the script before she got stuck into the nitty-gritty of the rewrite. Here's Katie Silverman at a Q&A in 2022, talking about the main structural perspective shift that she made to the script.
The original script by Carrie and Shane Van Dyke, two really talented writers, was such a fantastic concept and idea. And we read it and we were really excited to examine that same idea from a slightly different perspective, as the perspective maybe from two women who we wanted to explore a little more of the nuance of the spaces that everyone could agree were horrific versus the spaces that you could maybe convince yourself were okay, even if you know that foundationally they're based in something rotten. And so that was the North Star kind of that we were focused on the whole time in terms of being able to shift the focus a little bit from something that everyone would be able to shake their head at versus something that hopefully would make people question their own instincts about it.
The Katie Silverman draft of Don't Worry Darling that I've read is not the shooting script. It's a work-in-progress draft, dated 13th February 2020, which was 6 months after New Line bought the project and around the time that the film was being cast. Olivia Wilde initially intended to both direct and play the film's lead role, who had been renamed Alice, and she was considering Florence Pugh for the supporting role of Bunny, an elevated version of the neighbour Betsy from the Van Dyke script. But according to Wilde, she decided in late 2019 that Pugh was the one who should play Alice, so Wilde took the role of Bunny instead. Katie Silverman's draft was finished in February, so after that decision was made, but Alice is written as much closer to Wilde's age than Pugh's. And this February 2020 draft of Don't Worry Darling is, in my opinion, the best version of the film. It opens with sweeping shots of an idyllic town in the desert and a voiceover asking if you're ready to live the life you deserve. Because as an employee of the Oasis Project, you're invited to live in Oasis, a private community nestled in the middle of the California desert. We then hard cut to the boozy end of a suburban dinner party and our heroine, Alice, playing a party game and trying to dance with a tray of drinks on her head along with her friends Bunny and Peg, all for the amusement of their husbands. Alice and her husband Jack are very much in love, but as they drive home bantering, they see a figure out in the desert. Jack swerves to avoid them and Alice recognizes Margaret, their neighbor. She wants to drive back and pick her up, but Jack writes Margaret off as a lunatic and says he'll call her husband Ted when they get home. As they're driving away, Alice keeps looking back at Margaret until there's nothing but blackness that fades into a kaleidoscope of Busby Berkeley dancers in black and white, dancing and pulling out fans that fit together into an image of Alice's screaming face. Alice wakes up and brushes the dancers off as a bad dream. Breakfast is interrupted by a tremor that shakes the house, but Alice is clearly used to them, just mildly annoyed that this is the third one this week. Jack dashes off to work and Alice scrubs her hands like a surgeon and gets into her chores, whistling a song that she's had stuck in her head. But once she finishes cleaning, she just kind of stands there, like an NPC with nothing to do. Then she hears snipping noises over the fence and sees Margaret calmly decapitating all the rose bushes in her garden. Unnerved, Alice goes about her day and starts cooking dinner, but she's so distracted she cuts through her thumb and nearly severs it. Instinct kicks in and she cleans and stitches the wound before she can even really process it, but she doesn't tell Jack about the injury. The next day, they go to a party hosted by Frank, the friendly CEO and de facto mayor of Oasis. But while Frank's wife Shelley is making a speech to welcome a new couple to the neighborhood, Margaret starts yelling that there's something out there and that they're being hidden away in Oasis. Margaret's husband drags her away, and then Frank makes a vaguely cult-like speech about how they've created their own little world in Oasis, and this is how the world should be. Alice runs into Margaret inside, who reads her like a book and knows that she has bad dreams too. Alice is once again unnerved and goes to find Jack. He's in Frank's room, being a bit too into Frank's ties. They start to have sex, but Frank walks in. He excuses himself after watching a bit too long, and as they're leaving, Alice's eye catches on a black and white photo of the townspeople, very Shining-esque, which then transitions into another Busby Berkeley dancer sequence, more violent than the last. The next day, Alice and the girls go out shopping, and Bunny lays down the law for the newest Oasis wife, Violet. They don't ever talk to their husbands about work, they don't ask about the tremors, they don't drive, and they don't go out to Oasis headquarters. Or they'll end up like Margaret, who walked out into the desert with her son and came back alone. But even the warning about Margaret can't stop Alice's visions and compulsions. She sees screaming faces, tries to suffocate herself with cling wrap, and the next time she's riding the town bus, she sees a plane crash out in the desert. The bus driver refuses to leave his route, so Alice walks out into the desert alone, past a plethora of warning signs. She doesn't find the plane, but she eventually reaches Oasis headquarters. And calling for help, she pushes open the doors and goes into full sensory overload. Strobing lights, noises, images being projected onto walls, and she wakes up at home on the couch. Just for reveal tracking purposes, this is on page 33 of the script, which is also 95 pages long. So it's about a third of the way through, and it's far less explicit than the Van Dyke brothers reveal, which included futuristic tech, a creepy basement, and Clifford drugging Evelyn. This time around, it's just a flickering whiteout before Alice wakes up at home with no idea how she got there. Jack tells Alice that she was acting strange on the bus, so the driver dropped her home. No mention of the desert or the plane crash. The wound on Alice's hand has turned black, rotting away, and the next morning, while talking to Bunny and Violet, Alice sees another plane plunging into the desert. Bunny and Violet don't see anything, but over the fence, Margaret does. At the supermarket, Alice starts questioning where all the food comes from in the middle of the desert, and then when another tremor passes through town, all the employees and children in the store stare at her and open their mouths, unleashing an electronic scream. Alice rushes to Margaret's house, finally ready to put aside her fear of being called crazy and find out what's really going on, but she gets there just in time to see Margaret jump from the roof and impale herself on the white picket fence. And before Alice can help her, an army of service workers, the milkmen, mailmen, garbage men, all appear and drag Alice away from Margaret's corpse. And that night, Jack insists Margaret isn't dead. She's at the hospital getting stitches. And Alice starts to push Jack and asks what he really does at Oasis. He tells her to stop. Stop asking. Stop risking everything he's worked for. Stop acting delusional and get a hold of herself. And he rips the bandage off her hand to reveal nothing. Her thumb is completely healed. Not even a scar. Maybe nothing happened to begin with. And Alice's grip on what's real slips a little further the next day at the country club. When Margaret shows up, completely fine, better than fine, back to normal with some minor memory problems, saying how embarrassing it was that she slipped cleaning the windows. Alice tries to ask her what actually happened because she knows Margaret jumped and should be dead, and suddenly Alice is the one who sounds crazy. So Jack takes her to see Dr. Collins, who prescribes some tranquilizers, which we learn he's done before. As she's leaving, Alice hears Jack and the doctor arguing about her, and when she gets home, she checks out the fence that Margaret fell onto and realizes it's been repainted. Then Bunny's kids start glitching out in front of her, so Alice steals one of their bikes and rides it out to Oasis headquarters. She touches the door and whites out again, waking up on a bed surrounded by plastic curtains with 1950s ads and Busby Berkeley dancers being projected all around her. Alice tries to investigate, tries to operate an iPad next to the bed, and sees a photo of a couple, Bob and Kathy, marked as new users. Then she accidentally starts up a commercial for the Oasis, the idyllic footage and voiceover from the beginning of the film. This is on page 50, by the way. It's the midpoint of the film, which is also where Evelyn left the simulation and watched an expository commercial in the other draft. But again, this reveal is less explicit. In the Van Dyke draft, Dr. Anderson's video spelled out exactly what Altlife was and how Evelyn ended up there. And Evelyn then returned to the simulation knowing that Clifford was holding her hostage. But in this early Silberman draft, Frank's video is shorter and it's about being accepted into a brotherhood. It doesn't name anyone, and when Alice tries to get up and learn more, her legs are so wasted that she falls, hits her head, and she's back in the 50s in the bath. Jack tells her to get ready for the big anniversary party at the town nightclub and then throws out there that maybe they should have a baby before he gives her some tranquilizers. Alice uses the party to corner Margaret and ask again what is going on, but Margaret ducks away just as Frank takes the mic to welcome the newest residents of Oasis, Bob and Kathy, the couple that Alice saw on the iPad. Alice starts freaking out as Frank calls Jack up onto stage and announces he's getting a promotion, and Jack literally tap dances with joy as Alice hides in the bathroom and finally tells Bunny what she saw out at Oasis headquarters. Bunny doesn't believe her, so Alice drags her out there to see for herself. And as they drive into the desert, Frank makes a vaguely sinister speech about how they're all here because they know they don't need to heed what the rest of the world thinks is right. Out at headquarters, the doors are locked, but Alice crowbars them open to reveal a totally normal office lobby. Realizing Frank has somehow gotten one step ahead of her, Alice decides to meet him on her own turf. She invites him and Shelley and half the neighbors around for a dinner party. Frank corners Alice in the kitchen and admits that yes, he knew about her and Bunny's trip to headquarters, and he really did change the exit point. But he's not mad, he's fascinated by her. And just wants to see where this is going. So over dinner, Alice starts grilling the other women about where they're from, where they've been, what memories they have, and finds that all of them have the same stories. Frank punctures any revelations by mentioning Alice's medication, implying that she's taken baby crazy to a whole new level, and most of what Alice is saying does sound crazy. Alice doesn't have the language to describe what's wrong, what she's seen. She only knows that something is wrong and things aren't quite real in Oasis. So Frank pushes her, asking if Bunny's children are real. And Alice says no, because nothing here is really real, and Bunny is the one who tells her enough. Bunny finally gives up on Alice and leaves, and the rest of the dinner party slinks off, Frank smug and triumphant. As soon as the others are gone, Jack yells at Alice about what the fuck all of that was, and she finally tells him everything. What she's been seeing, feeling, how she thinks they've all been trapped there by Frank. And Jack believes her. He asks if he's trapped there too, and she says he must be, because they all are, they just don't realize it. And when Alice says they need to get out of there, Jack agrees. They get in the car, but Jack doesn't drive. He apologizes, says he loves her so much and tried to stop this happening, as the other husbands from Oasis all surround the car. Together, they grab Alice and take her to a hospital, where she's given electroshock therapy. And we see glimpses of another world, a modern hospital where a female doctor is operating. Alice. We follow Surgeon Alice, exhausted after a 36-hour shift, stuck in the lift with a schlubby pharmaceutical rep who tells her she works too hard and needs someone to take care of her. Alice mostly ignores him, looking at her phone, and it's only when she's leaving the lift that we see the pharmaceutical rep is 21st century Jack, watching Alice closely. In the simulation, Alice's shock therapy ends, but we stay in real life, following Jack as he tends to a captive, drugged Alice, whistling the same tune that Alice has had stuck in her head. The iPad says she's ready for a full reset, and Jack apologizes and says they'll fall in love all over again. And in Oasis, Alice is completely rebooted, just like Margaret was, back to being a happy housewife without a care in the world. She's welcomed back to the neighborhood, but one morning she's cleaning and she starts whistling the song again and stops dead. When Jack comes home, she's waiting for him with a drink and a smile, and it's only once he's been completely knocked out by the tranquilizers that she drops the act. Alice confronts Jack about the whole kidnapping her and putting her in the Tradwife Matrix thing, but Jack snaps and says he didn't kidnap her, he saved her, and that all the women in Oasis have been saved from a fucked, broken world full of hatred and violence and cruelty, that Frank has built a better world and she's lucky to get to live in it. Alice asks about the other women, whether they're all trapped somewhere like her, and Jack tells her not to think about them, just to think about her and him and the perfect life they can have together, being happy and not having to worry about anything. He tells her he loves her, and Alice responds that she doesn't care, then smashes a highball glass on his head and beats him to death with a golf club. Alice then hits the streets, covered in blood, smashing car windows and screaming to the other wives that they're all prisoners and they don't need to live like this. And everyone ignores her or shuts their doors, held back by their husbands or genuinely afraid of her. Eventually, Violet opens her door for Alice, but Frank is waiting inside for her. Alice is once again hospitalized, this time permanently. She withers into a husk of herself and then is finally visited by Bunny, who has hardened and become more commanding and has also managed to get Alice a day pass from the hospital. They drive to a cliffside, which Bunny tells her is the very edge of Oasis. If Alice jumps, she'll be free. Alice tries to convince Bunny to jump with her, but she won't leave her kids behind. So Alice goes alone. And as she falls, we hard cut to sweeping shots of the desert, and Oasis almost tripled in size, with a voiceover from Frank asking if you're ready to live the life you've always imagined. Like I said, this script is, for me, the strongest version of the film. The world is richer than the Van Dyke draft, with Oasis feeling like a real fleshed-out community with a complicated social hierarchy you'd want to defend your place in, although obviously the name had to be changed from Oasis to The Victory Project because Ready Player One has a monopoly on virtual realities called The Oasis. The decision to move the outside world from 2050 to the present day also makes everything much more immediate for the audience. We're not talking about a distant future where the re-election of a black female president has turned white men insane. We're talking about our world, where very small moves towards equality have completely broken some people's brains. But also where equality really means that everyone gets to miserably toil away under capitalism, regardless of gender. So some people are genuinely attracted to the idea of reverting back to a 1950s world, although they usually ignore the complicated geopolitical factors that mean we think of the 50s as a time of prosperity, and instead say we should just bring back racism. Frank is also a more persistent, insidious leader and villain in this draft than Dr. Anderson was in the Van Dyke script. And the way that he exercises power as a leader over the people around him feels quite true to actual cult leaders. He gets his subjects to police each other instead of enforcing much himself, and situating Frank as the main villain for most of the film holds back the reveal that Jack is the one who has personally trapped Alice in the Tradwife Matrix, allowing that beat to play as a complete betrayal. And Katie Silverman does some very delicate work to pull that off. For example, when Alice tells Jack she thinks they've all been trapped in the Oasis by Frank, he says he believes her, and then he asks if he's trapped there too. And it's a really nice detail, because first time around, this would seem to answer any lingering questions that the audience has about how much Jack knows, because it sounds like he doesn't know anything and he needs Alice to free him too. But on a second watch, this scene becomes Jack testing how much Alice knows and whether she's figured out where he fits into everything. So when she says it's all Frank, he lays it on really thick, acting like he has no idea what's going on. I also think this draft has a really good handle on what to reveal when. We know something is wrong from pretty much the second scene of the film, when we see Margaret out in the desert, and we know headquarters is the way to that strangeness at the end of the first act, but moving the definitive reveal that it's a simulation back to the midpoint also gives the audience more time to sit in the discomfort with Alice. But by confirming that this is a simulation at the midpoint, the audience then gets to feel the frustration of everyone else denying Alice's reality. The audience understands the simulation more than Alice does, because we haven't had our memories wiped and plugged into the 50s, so there's also an extra level of frustration in that. When everyone calls her crazy, we don't just know Alice is right, we know how right she is. Margaret and Alice's shifting places as the crazy lady in town also suggests there's a much wider awareness of the prison that they're living in, that anyone could notice something is wrong with Oasis, and any nonconformity is carefully stamped out by Frank and the husbands, with social isolation weaponized to stop a full-blown uprising. Also, this is getting a bit nitty-gritty, but Alice's real-world backstory is really neatly foreshadowed. There's obviously the automatic surgical reaction to cutting her thumb, but there's also an earlier beat of Alice washing her hands, which the big print in the script says is like a surgeon, both hands in the air, cleaning hard between the fingers. And this is great, because for a lot of people, this just looks like general germophobia. But if you've seen surgeons or medical professionals washing their hands, you'll know there's a very specific order and process and body language to it. So visually, this would have been an early signal of her backstory for some viewers, without overdoing it for others. And while the ending of the Silverman draft is a little bit low energy, the scene before it, where Alice is covered in blood, smashing car windows, screaming in the street that we're all being controlled, and everyone turns their back on her, I think that's a really powerful image, because we've been on Alice's journey, we know where she's coming from, but we can still understand why people shut her out. But as I said earlier, this draft was not the shooting script, and there was another idea that Olivia Wilde wanted to bring to the film, which we've actually already heard her mention. Here's Olivia Wilde again.
Because until you're willing to really stop participating in the system continues. And I thought about that so much. And I was like, I want to tell a story about that. That's what I want to talk about. Who's the kind of superhero or superheroine who is really willing to disrupt a system that is designed for them, and or at least designed to make them think that it's for them? And I was also thinking a lot about narratives that we accept without questioning them. And so we kind of applied those topics to this framework of this story and developed it to really try to explore that. Could you create a world that is so seductive that even the audience is like, just stay. Yeah. Just, it's fine. Because that's what we all do all the time. Like, we're so aware of how unjust our world is, but it's just so difficult to actually imagine truly disrupting it. Like, only real revolutionaries do that.
And this wasn't just a one-off comment from Wilde. In her director's statement for the film's premiere at the Venice Biennale, Wilde wrote, quote, "Imagine a life where you had everything you ever wanted. And not just the material or tangible things like a beautiful house, gorgeous cars, delicious food, endless parties, but the things that really matter, like true love with a perfect partner, and the best friends, and a purpose that feels meaningful. What would it take for you to give that up? What are you willing to sacrifice in order to do what's right? Are you willing to dismantle the system that is designed to serve you? That's the world and the question of Don't Worry, Darling. The problem is that this dramatic question is fundamentally opposed to the premise of Don't Worry, Darling, which I know is a very sweeping and academic statement, so let's break it down. The film is about a woman who has been trapped in a simulation of the 1950s where she lives as the housewife of the man who is holding her captive. And the 1950s setting functions as a metaphor for the imprisonment that Alice is living through. And she has been put into that simulation to serve Jack. Even if she's drinking cocktails by the pool and going shopping with her friends, that is not the purpose of the simulation. Those perks might have been put into the system, but the purpose of the system is for her to exist for Jack, like so many generations of women existed to serve as their husband's maid, cleaner, chef, and baby maker. It is not a system that is designed to serve Alice. So for Olivia Wilde to make this a film about what it takes to dismantle a system that is designed to serve you, the story had to be twisted into a shape that ultimately compromised both Wilde's directorial vision and the script. An easy way to sum up the problem is a comparison. Imagine if in Mulan, when Mulan rocked up to join the army, half of the soldiers were women. But the film still played out exactly the same. Mulan still dressed in drag, Shang still tried to make a man out of her, and she was still expelled from the army when it was revealed she was a woman. But in all crowd shots, the army was 50% women because the director decided that they wanted to have a gender-balanced cast. The story and that directorial intention cannot coexist. They cancel each other out. And weirdly enough, in the Heineck and Martin draft of the live-action Mulan remake, there was fully a female commander in the Chinese army who trained Mulan and the other recruits and basically took the Shang role, but I have been warned I have to keep my Mulan tangents to under 2 minutes per episode, so that's as much as I'll say about it. Don't Worry, Darling was meant to start filming in early 2020. However, certain events occurred, and the film's shoot was pushed back to October. As I mentioned before, Florence Pugh had been cast in the role of Alice, and Wilde was playing the supporting role of Bunny, and by mid-May 2020, the rest of the main cast was in place, with Chris Pine as Frank, Dakota Johnson as Margaret, and Shia LaBeouf as Jack. Dakota Johnson and Shia LaBeouf would not end up in the film. Johnson dropped out due to a scheduling conflict with The Lost Daughter, and she was eventually replaced by Kiki Layne, whose casting was announced shortly before production. Shia LaBeouf's replacement is a less simple matter. Olivia Wilde has said that she wanted Harry Styles for the role of Jack from the very beginning, but he was touring and unavailable, so LaBeouf was cast instead. In August 2020, Shia LaBeouf left the film, and at the time it was reported as another scheduling conflict. He was soon replaced by Harry Styles, whose tour had been cancelled due to the pappardelle. But in December 2020, Variety published an article with numerous accounts of LaBeouf's inappropriate behaviour, which included the allegation that he had actually been fired from Don't Worry Darling because he, quote, displayed poor behaviour and his style clashed with the cast and crews, including Wilde's, who ultimately fired him. A month later, in January 2021, The Hollywood Reporter claimed that Wilde and LaBeouf had also clashed on a music video for the artist Rainsford, which LaBeouf starred in and Wilde reportedly directed, although she is not credited because while she was working on her cut, LaBeouf submitted his own edit of the music video. And when Wilde said she'd look at his version and then hand in hers, LaBeouf replied via email that the correct response would have been to thank him and say they would go with his cut. Wilde reportedly replied, "I'm out," and had no further involvement with the video. And while it's hard to confirm exactly when this all occurred, the music video was released just a couple of days before Don't Worry Darling started shooting, so it's quite likely that this power struggle was happening around the time of LaBeouf's removal from the film. In August 2022, while promoting the film, Wilde confirmed that she had fired LaBeouf from Don't Worry Darling, telling Variety that, quote, "He has a process that, in some ways, seems to require a combative energy, and I don't personally believe that is conducive to the best performances." Shia LaBeouf then very publicly disputed this version of events. He said that he quit the film due to lack of rehearsal time and that he left so early in the process that Wilde couldn't have known what his immersive acting method entailed. He also published a number of private text messages and a video of Wilde several days after he claims to have quit, saying that she wasn't ready to give up on the buff and wanted to find a way to work through the problems he was apparently having with Florence Pugh. Wilde does not agree with LaBeouf's version of events. Here she is on The Late Show in 2022, really spelling it out with Stephen Colbert.
Early on in the process of making the film, as the director, I tried to mediate a situation between people to try to see if they could work together happily. Mm-hmm. Once it became clear that it was not a tenable working relationship, I was given an ultimatum. I chose my actress, which I'm very happy I did. At the time, was I bummed that we weren't able to make it work? Sure. Did information about him come to light later that made me confident we made the right decision? Absolutely.
So just to be clear here, did you fire Shia LaBeouf?
We had to replace Shia. He is a fantastic actor, but it wasn't going to work. And, you know, when he gave me the ultimatum of, you know, him or Florence, I chose Florence, and that was him feeling he was stepping away and me feeling like we were moving on without him.
As Wilde mentioned in that clip, things have since come to light about Shia LaBeouf and his tendency to twist narratives in the public view. His 2019 film Honey Boy purported to be a semi-autobiographical drama about his abusive childhood, but LaBeouf has since disowned the film and claimed that in it, he vilified his father on a grand scale. LaBeouf is also currently being sued by FKA Twigs for what she's described as relentless abuse. And while he initially issued a statement saying, quote, "I'm not in a position to tell anyone how my behavior made them feel," he has since denied all allegations in court. And I can't help but think of what Katie Silberman and Olivia Wilde wanted to explore in their version of Don't Worry, Darling. Not the cut-and-dried, obvious examples of historical sexism, but the more subtle ones, the ones that make you question your own perspective. The ones where we can be influenced by cultural norms and assumptions, where evidence can be taken out of context to make someone seem crazy or deceitful. The video of Olivia Wilde that Shia LaBeouf leaked to the press can be read in many ways. It could be seen as 100% confirmation of Shia LaBeouf's version of the story. Or it could be seen as Olivia Wilde, the director, trying to bridge the gap between two actors with different performance styles. Or it could be Wilde, the film's producer, trying to avoid a costly and complicated recasting process. Or it could be Wilde, the person, trying to avoid any further conflict with someone who is difficult and volatile by saying the things that she knows he wants to hear. Whatever happened, Shia LaBeouf left the film and was replaced with Harry Styles, who is both younger and significantly less experienced as an actor, but who also brought in a massive audience who weren't typical ticket buyers for a psychological thriller about a 1950s housewife. And Styles' performance in the film is, look, it's not great. And it's made worse by putting him in scenes with Florence Pugh, who is great. A lot has been said about Styles' wildly fluctuating accent, but to give full credit to him, it is explained in the film. Jack is an American in real life who has chosen to be British in the Victory Project simulation. So, accent inconsistencies could be read as a deliberate choice when the line between the two Jacks blurs.
What if Margaret was right?
Stop it, Alice.
What if this place is dangerous? What if-
Stop it! I'm part of something important, Alice. This mission, what Frank's doing, it matters.
I know that, baby, but you're not listening.
No, not everyone gets this opportunity. And if you keep talking like this, you're going to put it all at risk.
Or it could just be bad accent work. But on a much more basic level, Harry Styles brings a very different energy to Jack just as a younger actor. Shia LaBeouf is 10 years older than Florence Pugh, while Styles is around the same age, and there's an implied power imbalance in a relationship with a significant age gap that just isn't there between Pugh and Styles. And Alice and Jack's real-world relationship in the final film is very different to both versions of the script that we've talked about. In the Van Dyke draft, Evelyn and Clifford were divorced, while in the early Silberman draft, Jack was a stranger, obsessing over Alice and eventually kidnapping her. But in Wilde's film, Alice and Jack are in a relationship in the real world. But it's on its last legs, with Alice working insane hours while Jack stays at home listening to Frank's Jordan Peterson-style lectures.
Primary question is, you're so late. I thought thought you were going to be home by 10.
So did I. Surgery ran really long.
Well, I'm starving. I haven't eaten.
Why not?
I wasn't sure what you wanted, and you never text me back.
I don't have my phone in the OR, Jack.
Well, it'd be nice to know that.
And this is the one element of the film that I think eclipses either script, because it turns the film from a straight horror movie into something much more complex. And it makes Jack's decision to put Alice into the Victory Project no more acceptable, but more understandable and more socially permissible. Because in the film, he's not a stranger who watches her from afar or an ex who wants to control her. He's her partner. And Jack can tell himself that putting Alice in the Tradwife Matrix is an act of love. After all, while she's there, he has to go out and work. He just wants her to live a life of 1950s luxury, which happens to also include shaping her entire existence around him. This also turns Alice's fight to leave the Victory Project and get her life back into a fight to leave Jack. Something she was clearly on the brink of in the real world, but still unable to do. And at the very end of the film, right on the precipice of leaving Victory, the thing that makes Alice hesitate isn't jumping off a cliff and leaving Bunny behind, like it was in Silberman's earlier draft. It's memories of Jack and the good parts of their relationship. She has, at this point in the film, literally killed Jack, both in the simulation and in real life, but when Alice is about to open the door to freedom, Jack's ghost puts his arms around her and asks her to stay. And this moment has a nuance that's lacking from the rest of the film, tapping into the very real way that people stay in a bad relationship because it used to be good, and the pressure that they're put under to sideline their own future for the sake of the past. Jack has done inexcusable things to Alice, but she did love him once. And leaving Victory means leaving all of that behind, the good and the bad. But this is the only part of the film that comes close to being an improvement on the earlier script. Don't Worry Darling began principal photography in late October 2020. And the cast was rounded out with Kiki Lane replacing Dakota Johnson as Margaret, Gemma Chan as Frank's wife Shelley, and quite a few comedy actors. Nick Kroll, Kate Berlant, and Timothy Simons all have minor supporting roles. Nick Kroll is basically just playing himself, but Kate Berlant does really well in her few scenes playing Peg as someone who's terrified that their place in the friendship ranking is slipping, and Timothy Simons might actually be the standout performance of the film as Dr. Collins, because one look at that man says he cannot be trusted. Even if you can't say why, there's just something inherently unsettling about him. And Simons is probably the only actor in the film who isn't to any degree playing himself. He also fits the 1950s look much better than most of the other male actors who look like modern guys wearing 50s costumes. Simons looks so much like he's wandered off the set of Mad Men that you completely forget that that's Jonah from Veep. The costuming and general aesthetic of Don't Worry Darling is really interesting. It has a lush, pastel, Palm Springs colour palette to fit Wilde's fantasy theme. She wanted audiences to be seduced by the look of the film. But within the narrative, the simulation and the town of Victory was designed by Frank. So production designer Katie Byron approached the world as if Frank had made it. So it has an almost deliberately ahistorical look. A lot of the hair, makeup, and costuming is really infuriating to history nerds like me because it plays into a much more modern, male perception of 1950s fashion, not what it actually was, reflecting Frank's misconceptions about 1950s politics and the traditional family. It's the costume and makeup equivalent of Harry Styles' inconsistent accent. There was initially one hard rule for production design, but this was later deliberately broken when Wilde added a new group of characters to the film. Here's Olivia Wilde again.
It was funny because early on we had a rule, like nothing will be red. There will be no red. And then at one point Ariane was like, what if they're all in red. Like all the men in these jumpsuits. The jumpsuit idea was such a late in the game kind of revelation of these bots that would be the workers inside the simulated world. And because we had built the palette to have no trace of red, then that choice really popped and became really powerful.
These bots in red boiler suits replace the everyday service workers who dragged Alice away from the scene of Margaret's suicide. And they also appear around the town doing odd jobs in the film. And they really do stand out from the rest of the world. Although I will say both Alice and Margaret do wear red at different points in the film. But this really rigid, well-set color palette meant that the few glimpses that we got of Alice in her real life, in a mustard yellow sweater in a much grayer world, were clearly in another time and place entirely. By all reports, Olivia Wilde is a very collaborative director who likes to take new ideas and run with them. Here's writer Katie Silberman and Olivia Wilde talking about their working relationship on set.
I think the great benefit to me of developing stories and working with Olivia in that way is that you have such a constant sounding board as to what's working and not working. One of my other favorite things about working with her is how much of the script is a chemical equation of the actual act of making the movie. Like how much the story and the script continues to change based on who's cast, and then based on the locations that they find, and then based on ideas from other members of the crew. I think working with someone, and especially a leader who has such a clear and unshakable knowledge of what a story is, it allows for such amazing collaborations because she really values every other member of the crew in a way where people feel like they can bring ideas to the table, and we end up integrating so much of them.
We never stop.
Yeah.
I mean, never stop. Like, people would see us talking and be like, no, there's more pages. Yeah.
And there really were more pages coming. Wilde added ideas from crew members, like cinematographer Maddie Libatique, who suggested a scene where Alice was crushed by the walls of her own house, and costume designer Ariane Phillips, who suggested and organised a cameo from Dita Von Teese in the anniversary party scene. Those who've seen the film might have noticed as well that Shelley's ballet class doesn't appear in either draft of the script. In the film, Frank's wife Shelley runs a ballet class that all the wives attend multiple times, and on paper, it's a pretty neat addition to the film. Ballet is an incredibly athletic form of dance that demands a huge amount of discipline and effort to look effortless. It's often dismissed as feminine, it's very controlled, and a huge part of it is about aesthetics. Shelley also acts as another gatekeeper in the community, exercising the little control that she has over other women.
Stomach in. Chin up.
However, the ballet lessons gesture at the ideas of the film, but they never really connect to anything. They make up about 4 minutes of screen time, and if anything, these scenes end up detracting from one of the film's turning points. Just before Margaret's suicide, Alice sees a vision in ballet class where her reflection becomes Margaret, who tries to break through the mirror by hitting her head against the glass. And it's the first real streak of violence in the film. But because it comes just one scene before Margaret's actual suicide, this vision takes away from the shock of Margaret's death. Shelley is another interesting case of adaptation. Like on Booksmart, Katie Silberman adapted the characters to suit their actors, and with an actor as strong as Gemma Chan, Shelley was given a much larger role as the First Lady of Victory, and she's a willing participant. She even kills Frank and seems to take over Victory in the final minutes of the film.
You stupid, stupid man. It's my turn now.
Prior to this, Shelley has just been a colder, more practiced enforcer of Victory's status quo, most notably in the ballet classes, but also when Frank starts to notice Alice's non-compliance and decides to just kind of fuck around and find out how much she knows. When he deliberately antagonizes Alice at the dinner party, Shelley is the one who really puts her foot down.
And it's all about control. It's all about control. We wouldn't even know. He might be poisoning the food.
Enough! We come to your house, we sit at your table, and you insult and degrade my husband? He invites you to be a part of something as extraordinary as he is, and you sit there like a spoiled brat, demanding answers to questions you've made up. There's a pattern, isn't there? A pattern of selfish, pampered whining. Or is it just a desperation to be exciting? Spitting in the face of this opportunity. It's heartbreaking that your sad, desperate paranoia could destroy what we're trying to build. Well, I won't listen to your pathetic ranting any longer.
It's a big moment for Shelley, and an example of how women police each other to cling to the little power that they can hold in a sexist system. But you might remember that in that earlier draft of the script, it wasn't Shelley who shut Alice down in this scene and essentially turned the entire neighborhood against her. It was Bunny, who snapped and finally gave up on Alice for good when Alice implied that her children weren't real. And that's a much stronger turning point for Alice, to lose the unconditional support of her best friend rather than be shut down by a cold, watchful figure who has always been controlling and monitoring her behavior. So why the change from Bunny to Shelley? Why isn't Bunny in the dinner party scene at all? Well, in the film, Bunny and Alice don't go out to headquarters during the anniversary party. Instead, Bunny tells Alice to pull herself together, and Bunny's absence from the dinner party is treated as significant. Frank even taunts Alice about it.
Bunny, your best friend, is worried about you. She thinks that you need help. Is that why she's not here tonight?
But there was also a more practical reason why Bunny wasn't in this scene. Here's Olivia Wilde.
There was that dinner scene that they have where she really tries to confront Frank. Nick Kroll and my character were supposed to be in that dinner, and Nick was having a baby, and it was obviously during the pandemic. It was, you know, a concern to have him there at that time. We were shooting that scene, and he wasn't able to be there. I think he was also getting married. It was like there was a series of scheduling issues that we suddenly lost one of our main characters in the middle of the shoot. And it was such a clear opportunity to take us out of that scene, which added to the story because they've had this big argument the night before. So it was then much more meaningful to have Bunny and Dean, these two characters, not there. It also meant I could then be by the monitor watching that scene, which was much better. I mean, I truly only wanted to ever be by the monitor. I had so much fun acting with this amazing cast, but, you know, my happy place is very much behind the camera.
Bunny still has quite a significant role in the film, as Alice's best friend, but also as a louder, brasher wife who is just as controlling as Shelley. Bunny shuts down discussion of what their husbands really do in the desert. She shuts down talk about Margaret, and she tells Alice that she's acting crazy. But it's revealed in one of the film's last dialogue scenes that Bunny also already knows that they're in a simulation, and that she's there voluntarily.
I've always known. I chose this. My kids are here.
Bunny, your kids aren't real.
They are.
Kids aren't real.
No, they are. They're real
Nothing
to me.
Is
they're real.
Real
to me, Alice,
Nothing
because
here they're alive. In here, I didn't lose them.
Here, I can keep them.
And for me, this kind of offers a perfect solution to the tension between Wilde's vision and the script. Just make the film about Bunny, who has rejected the real world in favor of a fantasy and who now has to bury any questions she has about the other wives and the true nature of the simulation if she ever wants to be happy. Bunny is being served by this society, but no matter how much it serves her, it still needs to be dismantled. But Don't Worry, Darling isn't about Bunny or even about Shelley. It's about Alice, who has been kidnapped and plugged into the Tradwife Matrix. This is not a system that serves Alice because it's not one she has any control over or choice in. And nothing better captures the issue with applying Wilde's dismantle the system that serves you vision to this particular script than the film's sex scenes. Don't Worry, Darling was partly marketed as a feminist erotic thriller. And in a Variety profile released just before the film, Olivia Wilde declared that, quote, "men don't come in this film," before going on to question the fact that most of the female pleasure she'd seen in film in recent years had been in queer films, while in heterosex scenes, the focus on men as the recipients of pleasure was almost ubiquitous. And Olivia Wilde is right to question the gender dynamics of sex scenes in films. There is a lot to unpack and discuss. Alice and Jack are shown in Don't Worry Darling as having an idyllic, equal partnership, and the sex scenes focus primarily on Alice's pleasure. A lot of hay was made out of a lengthy scene of Jack going down on her. And all of this fits within Wilde's vision of victory as a fantasy, as a place you wouldn't want to leave or dismantle. But Alice is not knowingly or voluntarily in victory. She is being held prisoner, and she has no bodily autonomy. Meaning all the sex scenes in this film are effectively rape. The film is less explicit about this than the Van Dyke draft was, but it is still made very clear. Alice is restrained, drugged, and emaciated in the real world, and there is a very confronting shot from her point of view of her bare legs being dragged across the floor when she realizes the nature of the simulation. We've talked a lot this episode about twist and reveal placement and the balancing act you have to do between revealing things to both your audience and your characters. And a really basic but good rule of thumb for a good twist is that once you know it, you should be able to rewatch the film with new eyes. Pick up on all the things you missed the first time around. See the sleight of hand that was pulled on you. But once you know the twist in Don't Worry Darling, the way that it tries to have its cake and eat it too with Jack and Alice's relationship becomes far more unsettling than anything the film is actually trying to say. And once the audience knows Alice is a prisoner in Victory, they cannot buy into any fantasy of a system that serves you. Which meant that to keep the fantasy going, Olivia Wilde had to push back the reveal that Alice was in a simulation at all. In the Van Dyke draft, Evelyn woke up in the basement on page 21. In Katie Silberman's early script, Alice whited out after visiting headquarters on page 33, then fully left the simulation when she went back to headquarters on page 50. In the film, Alice never fully leaves the simulation. Even at the very end, we only get the implication that she has gotten out. The closest we get to a reveal of the real world is the flashback during Alice's electroshock therapy, which happens 1 hour and 25 minutes into the film. She is then rebooted but has her full memories triggered by Jack humming their song at the 1 hour, 31 minute mark. That is when the film reveals that Victory is a simulation, 91 minutes in. Which means up until that point, the film has played Frank as the mastermind of a bizarre cult-like society building questionable weapons, obfuscating and throwing every red herring it can to avoid playing its hand. This is as good a time as any to mention the film's length. Both the Van Dyke brothers and the early Silberman drafts of Don't Worry Darling are 95 pages. A screenwriting rule of thumb is that a single page usually means 1 minute of screen time. Obviously, there are exceptions, but both of those drafts read like tight 95-minute thrillers. The film runs for 115 minutes, and it feels long, partly because moving the reveal back so far means that it marks time for most of its duration, but also because no real meat has been added to the bones of the screenplay. That extra 20 minutes comes from imagery, repetition of the same ideas, and abstractions on the theme, often in ways that confuse rather than clarify. And because the reveal comes so late, Alice has no time to really deal with it in any way. In the earlier draft, she knew for the entire second half of the movie that she was trapped in something, maybe a simulation, maybe a cult, maybe a weird otherworldly environment, but she knew she was trapped, so the reveal that Jack was the one who trapped her there was both a reveal and a deep betrayal. But in the film, those two reveals come simultaneously, and Alice doesn't have time to process either. So she screams at Jack, and he screams at her, and then begs her to stay, and while she's concerned about the other wives, and he tells her not to worry, Alice doesn't shift to cold fury like she did in the earlier script. Instead, she's just horrified. Jack, meanwhile, is holding her around the waist, begging her to stay, and when his grip tightens, Alice tries to push him off, but can't. And in the struggle, she grabs a glass and smashes it against his head. It's a real weapon of last resort in the moment, a reaction rather than a deliberate killing. But Jack is still dead by the end of that scene. And suddenly Frank is the main villain again. Bunny finds Alice covered in blood and tells her to run, but Alice still takes the time to walk out into the cul-de-sac and stare accusingly at the watching Victory citizens, seeming to plant the seed of rebellion in the other wives before she takes Jack's Corvette and floors it across the desert to Victory headquarters, chased by Dr. Collins and the red-suited bots who do Frank's will. So after the big reveal, 91 minutes in, the last 20 minutes of the movie are mostly dedicated to a car chase. And here we run into another practical call that Olivia Wilde made, which would have made a lot of sense in the moment, but ultimately detracts from the meaning of the scene. Because, as originally planned, this scene wasn't Alice being chased down by Frank's minions, it was Alice being pursued by the men of Victory.
One big surprise, actually, that was a fun thing was that we realized at a certain point that the stunt guys who were going to double the husbands, the original end of the film was that all the husbands chased the women to try to prevent them from leaving. And I was doubling all of them and it was tricky to find the right doubles. And then I thought, you know, why don't we just make the stunt guys these operatives, these agents, these bots to go and chase them? They're much more terrifying. And then we don't have to double the guys. And it was an opportunity to let the stunt guys act.
Having the husbands of the town chase Alice down makes a very clear point. It's a high-stakes escalation of the way that people who've previously been your friend can turn on you in a moment if you question their privilege. The idea that you need to fight your way out of a metaphor for a systemic problem also really externalizes the goal. Think about that Ron Bass quote from way earlier about how male writers and characters tend to be goal-oriented, and they see the narrative as something that can be won. So instead of the scripted ending where Alice had to overcome her mind and find strength to push back against a world that called her crazy and institutionalized her, well, in a car chase, she gets a clear-cut escape, one that she earns by outsmarting and outdriving the patriarchy. And when it's the husbands chasing Alice down, there is a point being made in the car chase. But in the film, it's not the husbands, it's an unstoppable army of Frank's bots whose only purpose is to quash rebellion and follow orders. It becomes about Frank, and only Frank. The direction of the car chase also really deliberately dehumanizes the bots. They're all dressed the same, they have no personalities, and they even clamber over the sun-bleached landscape like ants, not people, an unstoppable force that can and will tear Alice apart. But it isn't personal. Because of the way that Wilde chose to direct the scene, it goes from being about the way that men will close ranks to defend the status quo into being about bots on Twitter. Don't Worry Darling finished principal photography in February 2021. And despite all of the changes that we've already been through between Silberman's early script and the final film, one of the biggest and most confusing changes to Don't Worry Darling actually happened entirely in the edit. And that's the almost complete erasure of Margaret. Kiki Layne's casting made Margaret the most prominent black woman in the film, and the potential for subtext and also just straight up text is obvious. History is full of black women whose warnings were ignored, dismissed, or diminished due to both racism and sexism. However, Don't Worry Darling doesn't explore this. And it doesn't explore much at all in regards to Margaret because her role was severely cut down. And her absence is particularly obvious when compared to the earlier Silberman draft of the script. Many scenes that previously had Margaret in them are still in the film, but Margaret herself has been cut out. The early scene of Jack and Alice driving home across the desert is in the film, but they don't come across Margaret out wandering alone. Instead, Jack and Alice just do some dangerous drunk driving, laugh, and make out. It's a kind of stunningly unnecessary scene without Margaret, since it does nothing that the previous scene didn't in terms of setting up Jack and Alice's relationship. And my guess is it was only kept in the film because it's the one time we see Alice driving before the car chase finale. Olivia Wilde has talked about working with her editor and making a joint decision to remove the more sinister tones from earlier scenes in the film. And while in this clip she isn't specifically talking about Margaret, this was probably the rationale for losing Margaret from those early scenes.
my editor, Afonso Goncalves, who's amazing, he was the one who said, I think we should let the movie be really kind of seductive in the beginning in terms of like letting the world be really vibrant and pleasant. The movie used to start with like much more sinister tones in the beginning. The dancers appeared in the very first shot. And he was the one who said, let it just be something that lures us in and let the sinister reality bubble up later. And of course, my panic was like, well, then will it be too boring in the beginning? Do we need to bring those kind of more shocking elements in early? And he allowed me to have the confidence to kind of be more patient.
And once again, it all comes down to fantasy. Margaret's presence so early disrupts the fantasy world of a system that serves you. So instead of being a jolt to the audience early on, Margaret just comes up in dialogue a few scenes later. She first appears in person about 10 minutes into the film, standing in her yard clasping a red toy plane. And then we get her backstory from Bunny a few scenes later. And Margaret then makes a brief interjection during Shelley's speech at Frank's party, but she doesn't yell and her questions don't act as a red herring like they did in the earlier script. Alice then finds Ted trying to give her some sedatives and they speak briefly with Margaret seeming to see through Alice and know that they're the same. But after that, Margaret's entire role in the film is to call Alice on the phone, appear in the mirror at ballet class, then kill herself. Margaret's suicide was also changed from the highly symbolic impalement on a white picket fence to her slitting her own throat while standing on her roof. This was part of a wider trend in the film of softening images of violence. Alice now accidentally killed Jack with a single blow rather than beating him to death with a golf club, and the scene of Alice almost cutting off her thumb was completely cut and replaced with her discovering that all the eggs in the house were empty shells, which doesn't actually stack up with a recurring montage of her making eggs for breakfast, but we're gonna zoom right past that so we don't sound like cinema sins. But the changes to Margaret's suicide in particular affected the flow of the plot. In the earlier script, after everyone told Alice that Margaret was fine and just needed some stitches, Alice realized that the fence had been repainted. It was an important beat that told Alice she should believe her eyes, and it pushed her to go back out to headquarters and leave the simulation on purpose. But the equivalent moment in the film feels like a narrative churn. Alice asks Dr. Collins what happened to Margaret. He says that she's fine, but her problems are so severe that Ted has lost his job and they will no longer be living in Victory. And then Alice steals Margaret's medical record and finds it heavily redacted, with only the words refused treatment visible. So she burns the record and starts day drinking. And we never see Margaret again. In the film, Margaret is not rebooted. She does not return as a blank slate reprogrammed wife. Once she dies, she stays dead. And this impacts the entire second half of the film. Margaret's return in the script inverts her relationship with Alice, so Alice is now the one babbling about the world being fake to a Margaret who doesn't want to hear it. Removing Margaret's reboot also means that when Alice is rebooted, there's no reference point for the audience. In the script, we know what a reboot looks like, and it's a complete loss of self and identity. But it also brings back social approval. By losing herself to the programming, Margaret is welcomed back into Victory society, and she doesn't want to lose that. In the early script, when Alice tries to talk to Margaret at the anniversary party, she asks what Margaret knows, what they're making her cover up, and the big print of the script says the quiet part out loud, that Margaret is looking at Alice the way they all used to look at Margaret, like her crazy might be contagious. None of this is in the film, but it was almost definitely shot. Kiki Layne was on set for the anniversary party scenes in costume. They actually put her in a bright red dress and red jewelry for this scene, which is a really interesting choice given the color palette of the film. It suggests a complete reprogramming that Margaret is now one of the drones, just like the red suited enforcers. Margaret and Ted were also originally in the scene right before the car chase, where Alice stares at the women of the town and plants the seed of rebellion in them. In the film, Alice looks at each of the wives individually, but because Bunny has already spoken to her, that really just leaves Violet and Peg. So once you know Margaret was meant to be in the scene, it makes more sense just with the rule of threes. And we only know that Margaret was in these scenes because Kiki Layne posted several behind-the-scenes photos to her Instagram, where she also noted that most of her scenes had been left on the cutting room floor. In the final film, Margaret dies 40 minutes in and stays dead. Her story is set up, but never paid off. Instead, the fact that her breakdown has cost Ted his place in the Victory Project was added with ADR.
She made it impossible for Ted to do his job, so he no longer works for the Victory Project.
And I can't, for the life of me, work out why Margaret's return was cut. Because even in the name of a fantasy or a system that serves you, by the time she slits her throat, that fantasy is gone. The world can no longer be seductive for Alice. It can't seem like a system that serves her, because that's the system that pushed her friend to kill herself. The best reason I can think of for cutting Margaret's return is that it maybe overcomplicated the film's second half. But to remove her from the film entirely, you would have had to oversimplify the first half. It's just a baffling decision, and one that seriously affects the film. Olivia Wilde set out to make a film about what it takes to push against a system that serves you, to put your own comfort aside and change things. And how very few people are actually willing to do that. But there are a lot of flaws in that premise. It takes the collective social movement that's needed for real change and turns it into the individual quest of an exceptional hero. And the idea of a system that serves you is especially flawed as a feminist metaphor. It assumes that the system is serving women, which it blatantly isn't. It wasn't in the 50s, it isn't now, and Victory isn't divorced enough from either of those to pass as a system that genuinely serves Alice. And I can't speak to Olivia Wilde's life experiences, but we do have something in common. We're both white women. And in my experience, that means living in a system that serves you on one hand and treats you as inferior on the other. And I want to believe that being white has never affected my work or career, but I can only think that because whiteness is treated as a default in Australia, especially behind the camera in the media, so it has never been a barrier to my career. It is tempting to think that we live in a meritocracy because that would mean that I've earned everything I've ever gotten. But to think that, I would have to accept and ignore an unfair system. Whiteness is a system that serves me. And it's one that has to be dismantled. But I don't think it takes heroic bravery from white people to do that. I think it takes basic empathy. And just to be totally clear, I'm not calling Olivia Wilde racist. I'm saying that her film took a quote-unquote colorblind approach that resulted in massive racial blind spots. Don't Worry, Darling doesn't just ignore race, it throws its one prominent black character under the bus. Margaret is the canary in the coal mine, but any nuance for the character, any real meat or screen presence, was removed so the world could better pass as a white woman's 50s fantasy. And because Margaret doesn't return in the film, Alice's eventual reboot also carries the unfortunate implication that Alice is somehow superior to Margaret, and that she deserves a second chance where Margaret didn't. There is a kind of hack saying that all publicity is good publicity, which can very quickly be disproven by whatever dumb shit Elon Musk has done the week that this comes out. But I said at the start of all of this that I would not be commenting on Spitgate or any of the associated Don't Worry drama, and I won't. But I will say that before the controversy all kicked off with Shia LaBeouf saying he wasn't fired, a research group called The Quorum did some polling to measure audience awareness and interest in the film, basically measuring the success of the film's marketing campaign. And at the time, they found around 16 to 17% of people polled were aware of Don't Worry, Darling, which means 83% of people hadn't even heard of it. But 2 weeks later, after Venice and Spitgate and Spritzgate, The Quorum did another round of polling, and awareness for the film had more than doubled. And by a 2-to-1 margin, people were more interested in buying a ticket after the drama than they had been before. With one big caveat, those polls said that they would be less likely to see the film if the reviews were bad, which they were. And by the time it was released, Don't Worry, Darling's budget had almost doubled, When studios were originally bidding for the project in 2019, the $20 million budget was a real selling point, given that the film's concept was a bit out there and it didn't necessarily have a broad four-quadrant appeal and would almost definitely be rated R in the US. $20 million was a safe amount to be investing in the film. But by the time it was finished, the film was widely reported as costing $35 million, most likely due to its longer runtime, the expensive action sequences, and COVID shooting protocols. This wasn't an unexpected blowout. New Line and Warner Brothers would have approved the budget increases as they happened. But it was a calculated risk, made before Don't Worry Darling was a punchline. In the end, Don't Worry Darling earned just under $20 million in its North American opening weekend, with another $10 million internationally, which is pretty exceptional. But it dropped to just $7 million in its second weekend. The film ended up making about $86 million total, which, accounting for advertising and studio share of box office, may have broken even or may not have. Olivia Wilde was attached to direct three projects after Don't Worry Darling, but none of them have gone into production. Don't Worry Darling is not a good film. It bites off more than it can chew and it spits out half of what it wants to say. It cannot reconcile its intentions with its content, and it's 20 minutes too long. But it's nowhere near as bad as a lot of the write-ups and drama around it suggested that it would be. And it's a shame that all the good work that went into it, the production design and the cinematography and the costumes and the script drafts, all of that is undone by a twist that comes just too late, and the directorial intention that pushed it back that far. I said earlier that the real test of a film with a twist is whether you can watch it twice and get new things the second time around. I've seen Don't Worry Darling more than twice, and every time I notice more unfulfilled setups or strange inconsistencies. But every time I go back to Katie Silberman's early draft of the film, I pick up something new that really works. A little bit of double handling, a setup and reveal, or a really funny hard cut gag. And it's a shame that such a strong script was slowly stripped back and dismantled by a directorial vision that just didn't serve it. Going Rogue is written and presented by me, Tenzie Gardam, with editorial assistance from Charles O'Grady and Christian Byers. If you're enjoying the show, please tell your mates and chuck us a good review on whatever app you're using, and also subscribe if you haven't already, because our next episode is about the hottest spec script of 2007, Nottingham, a radical retelling of the Robin Hood legend, and the wild rewriting journey that it went on to become Ridley Scott's Robin Hood. You can follow the show and me on Blue Sky, Tumblr, and Twitter, or you can email us now, goingroguetanzie@gmail.com. We have opened the emails. Please do not abuse this privilege. Our music, as always, is by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech and Shane Ivers from Silverman Sound Studios. Our logo uses a photo by Annika Mickelson, and this particular episode's artwork uses a paparazzi photo taken during the Don't Worry Darling shoot, which I think better captures the vibe of the movie than most of the movie. And it also shows off the incredible red dress that Margaret was meant to be wearing in the anniversary party scenes.